Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
It's the belief that I can be the master of how I react to any situation, that it's not the situation that I should blame. Ultimately, if things go off the rails, it's how I reacted to it.
From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. So our guest this week is, at first blush, at least, somewhat counterintuitive. Tom Bergeron, you may know the guy from Dancing with the Stars, where he's the host. He's hosted plenty of other shows over the years. But he's also a long-term and very dedicated meditator. He even wrote about it quite extensively in a book called I'm Hosting as Fast as I Can, which came out many years ago. I've wanted to have him on for a while. I finally was able to wrangle it, and we're posting it in conjunction with the season premiere of Dancing with the Stars. One of the things, and you'll hear this, he is different in some striking and very interesting ways than you might think by watching the guy on television. So with that, here he is, Tom Bergeron. I've been watching you since I was a little boy in Boston, and when I had a sick day when I didn't have to go to school, yeah, I'd be able to watch a talk show that was produced locally called People Are Talking,
yeah,
hosted by a guy named Tom Bergeron.
Right.
And then I watched your career just blossom ever since. You were on a little show called America's Funniest Home Videos,
yeah,
Hollywood Squares, and now, what's the name of the show on ABC?
That dancing thing.
Dancing with the Stars,
yeah,
yes. And what really caught my... I've met you briefly, right, fleetingly on the set of Good Morning America on occasion, but what really caught my attention about you is that you wrote a whole book about meditation.
It really was. It was sort of a stealth book about meditation.
Yeah.
It was called I'm Hosting as Fast as I Can was the main title. And under the guise of stringing together a bunch of career anecdotes, it really was a book about meditation. It really was a book about the importance of being present in your life and being in the now of your life. And that was the only reason I thought it would have any merit, is if there was some kind of takeaway.
What was interesting to me, and it's been a minute since I've looked at the book, but really what screamed out to me was that behind this sort of wall of affability,
yeah,
there's you're a complex human being.
Well, I think we all are.
Yes,
and you know, that's certainly what brought you to this whole experience of doing this book and this podcast. And it's that we are complex. I mean, one of the things that I had to deal with, and still do, it's still there right under the surface, is a really bad temper.
Really?
And
you would, I mean, nobody would ever guess.
Well, good.
That.
That's good. It means the meditation's working.
But, and you're a great host.
Yeah, thank you. But yeah, there were a few apartment walls in my single days that you know, had holes in the sheetrock that I punched through. And as I've said, apparently just putting a poster over it when you leave the apartment does not get you your security deposit back.
No.
But what it did when I met my wife and we were dating, and she could see, and it was the temper thing was always directed at inanimate objects or myself. But there was one time we were out and something happened, and I put my fist into the door of the car, just, oh, damn it. And she wisely said, you know, if we're going to have a relationship, that has to stop. And I had dabbled in meditation before, off and on, but I think the next day I signed up for a course in TM.
Transcendental meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
So TM comes up on the show quite a bit. But I always ask people just to sort of describe what it is so the listener understands.
Yeah, I'm not really a meditation purist. I mean, I sometimes, and I don't mean to disparage one brand over another, but to me, there's a central technique to meditation, and it's the discipline of finding a focal point, be it a mantra, as it is in my case, or a word that means something to you, or your breath, or, you know, focusing on a flickering flame, whatever. But it is that discipline of sitting and trying to quiet your thoughts. In the case of TM, they give you a Sanskrit mantra that they say after you go through the initial training is picked, you know, for you, and that's fine. And it certainly worked. I've done it for over 35 years. I meditated
wow.
this morning.
Wow. So they recommend that people do 20 minutes twice a day.
Yeah, I don't always do that. Like this morning, I did a half hour just because it was so, it was, and you probably experienced this too. There are times when, you know, you're kind of opening your eye and checking the digital clock, and it's taking forever. And other times you just fall into this wonderful sense of pure energy that is just amazing and is something I'm drawn to every day. I really am.
Unpack that for me. Pure energy. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think when I've meditated and meditate regularly in that process, there is a point at which, and sometimes it's only minutes into it, and I would just add as a side note, thoughts always intrude. People who stop meditating because they think they're failing because thoughts intrude, I've been doing it for, like I said, 35 years, they always intrude. And it's fine. You just don't judge them. You acknowledge them. You move them aside. You go back to your focal point. The mantra for me. And then there's a moment sometimes, it's almost like a runner's high, when I stop feeling where my feet and my fingers are, and I just feel like energy. And it's in those moments that the connective tissue that I really believe exists among us all and everything starts to feel very visceral. It starts to, you know, I'm kind of, okay, I get this now. And then, you know, then I come out of it and go on with my life, but it impacts it, whether it's hosting a TV show or just how I deal with traffic or anything or any incoming stressor, it helps.
So that in those moments, if I understand correctly, you are, to use the T in TM, transcending the small Tom Bergeron, the ego, sense of being this embattled, isolated self against the world, you actually, some of that stuff starts to evaporate a little.
Absolutely. Alan Watts used to, one of the phrases, and he had many I loved, we're all egos in bags of skin.
Yeah.
And in those moments, that ego and that sense of being a bag of skin, if you will, tends to fade away. And you get the sense, or I get the sense of something more connected. And it increases everything. It increases, I think, empathy. It increases my sense of where I am at any given moment in the day of my life. And I think it, and I love your title because I think it does make you happier. It does make you better able to assess things as they're happening so as to not fly off the, I have not damaged any sheetrock in 35 years, I'm proud to say. Sheetrock is safe now.
but does the temper go, I mean, you have a stressful job. You do a lot of live television. You got a lot of people whispering in your ear. Just watching Dancing with the Stars. It would be hard for people to know this if they haven't tried to host something, but I've done a certain amount of hosting, like a fraction, tiny fraction of what you've done. But to see how masterful you manage all of these moving parts, and it's all live, and there's so many different people, the judges and the contestants and the audience and your co-host, I would imagine at times that there's a certain amount of stress that still after 35 years might seep through, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Paradoxically, those 2 hours are the most relaxed I am all day. I've said before, it's like I have bedroom slippers on, and I'm doing this, and I love it, and I'm aware and listening, and I'm going to pile metaphors on. It's like, you know, kid on Christmas morning, something's going to happen. I'm going to unwrap something. I'm going to be aware of something. It's all about the excitement of being present, to have all those moving parts. And where I have a harder time isn't just real life, you know, where sometimes I'm more apt to feel annoyed at normal stuff. But in an environment like that, a three-ring circus like that, completely relaxed.
That's so interesting. So do you think that meditation has helped you in your natural milieu of hosting?
Absolutely.
Live?
Oh, yeah. No question. Between the dress rehearsal that we do on a Monday and the live show, we go live to the East Coast at 5 o'clock Pacific time. I meditate in my dressing room, and the staff knows now. You know, if we knock and he doesn't answer, he's probably, you know, if he's not at craft services, he's meditating. And I'll do that for, you know, whatever I can. Sometimes I can eke out only 10 minutes, sometimes a full 20, but it helps. Yeah,
and so. I would love to know more. This, now I'm asking this question completely selfishly because I too do a certain amount of live hosting.
Right.
Can you walk me through it, like how it's useful in those moments? Because I feel you never show You never show any stress when I see you hosting Dancing with the Stars, but I feel a little stressed because I'm projecting myself into your shoes and your bedroom slippers, as it were, and I'm thinking, well, how does he manage all of this? So can you give me a sense of how 35 years of meditation might show up for you in those times?
I think the key thing is, the first word that comes to mind to answer that question is trust. I trust that because of the practice, because of the investment of time and mental energy into being present, that I'm going to be aware of, or I'm going to somehow know how to roll with whatever happens, be it, you know, somebody passing out as happened a few years ago, or you know, a judge going a little crazy, or, you know, just an awkward moment that needs to be finessed to move us forward in the show, so we don't get caught, you know, that the wheels don't spin in this awkward. So I trust that. I really go out knowing. As a matter of fact, one of our former executive producers, Rob Wade, one time there was a power failure at CBS Television City, where we do the show. We lease studio space from them. And there was a power failure, and we'd only have certain lights, and I was thrilled. And Rob came up to me and he said, "Damn it, you love this, don't you?" And because it's like, how do we play with it? What, you know, it's a ballroom show. It's not neurosurgery. Let's, you know, have a good time, you know?
It's so interesting to me you use the word trust, because just, again, speaking from my limited experience, when I say limited experience, I mean not only limited experience in hosting, but also in meditating, because I've only been doing it for 8 years, and I've only been doing hosting truly in a way that would overlap with the type of hosting you've done in the past 7 years on Good Morning America, mm-hmm. on the weekends, where I was kind of thrust in this position where, before that, I was a traditional news anchor, just reading off of a teleprompter. It was just me. And then I had to make this transition to being in a three-ring kind of news circus in the mornings. But
isn't that fun, the shifting gears?
It is, but it was very hard for me to make that transition. Yeah. And I have to be honest, I was really bad at it for a long time. And I'm not just being – that's not false modesty.
Yeah.
If you look at my Twitter feed from that time, I was being told how bad I was.
Eviscerated by
– Absolutely. Yeah. And I think they were correct. And actually, it was, you know, we can talk about how mean Twitter is, but actually it was sort of useful for me to see, okay, I'm a little tight here.
Yeah.
And and then last year, I actually hosted a game show on ABC that I can now add to my list of credits, failed game show host, because that game show did not get renewed. But the word trust has come up over and over for me, because in recent years, I've become more and more comfortable, and so I found myself saying funny things occasionally, or things that people laugh at, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know where it comes from, and I get nervous that I'm not going to be able to do it again. I walk into the show the next day, and I'm like, well, everybody said I was funny yesterday, but am I going to be able to be funny today? I don't know, because I can't plan the jokes. And in fact, when I do plan a joke, it always fails.
For me, too.
So trust is a real thing, and I actually think meditation has helped me just kind of get out of my own way, stop planning the next move, stop just spinning, and just be open to whatever's happening, and trust that actually some thought will, or idea or wisecrack or whatever will come. It doesn't always come, but if I trust it, it's more likely to.
The couple things came to mind as you were saying that. One was an evening years ago, I would do a one-man show, and there was an improv section in that, and I would take from one member of the audience, just yell a profession. And from another member of the audience, I'd yell a situation, and I'll pick one of the, and I would do something in an improvisational setting. And so, boom, boom, and I did it, and it was magic. It was like it was being written from up above and sent to me, and I was instantly doing it perfectly, and the audience was ecstatic, and my agent at the time, her jaw dropped. It was one of those moments. And I just, and then I made the fatal mistake, as the applause was ebbing, I went, I'm really good. And the next improv sucked. The moment I got my ego in it, instead of enjoying this communal sharing of energy that had just happened, instead of making it about, wow, this experience that we just had was cool, let's see if we can have another one, it was, I really am amazing. And then You know,
I've had that happen over and over again.
But to me, anytime I've tried to, and as a matter of fact, in the first season of Dancing with the Stars, which was only 6 weeks in the summer of 2005, there was a lot of written stuff. And I'm very good friends with the guy who wrote it, and we've worked together for years. But ultimately, I said, and I wrote about this in that book, this doesn't feel right. I'm hosting a live show. Things are happening in the moment, and I've got a scripted line. However good that might be, it's no longer germane to what just happened. So I've got to, again, trust, and the producers thankfully ultimately agreed with me, that I'll respond appropriately. And it might be funny sometimes, it might be sympathetic sometimes, it might be dogmatic, but it'll be appropriate to the moment, and you can't script that. You just can't. So trust became very important in how we as a team on Dancing with the Stars allowed me to do the hosting the way I thought it should be done.
So interesting. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about when you're outside of the bedroom slippers, so the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Because clearly you just, I mean, it just emanates off you how much you love doing live hosting.
I do.
But the rest
do.
Of life is messy and complicated.
Yeah.
And now you've got this 35 years of practice under your belt. Can you just walk us through a little bit of how it shows up in the 22 hours a day when you're not on live television?
Yeah, sometimes it's the smallest things. Being in traffic. Getting to the studio to do Dancing with the Stars, depending on when I leave the house in L.A., anybody who's been out there knows that 20 minutes of difference can mean an extra hour and a half in the car. And I remember being in Laurel Canyon, just in bumper-to-bumper traffic, just getting to there's a merge that takes forever, and I had left too late, and I decided, all right, I'm going to turn off the radio, and watch how, this sounds silly, but it works. Watch how light plays on surfaces. You know, and just whether it's in the trees, on the cars, the energy of people around me, just be in this environment. Stop wishing I could go faster, be there sooner, be somewhere else. Oh, damn it, I wish I took the other road instead of this road. Be here now. What is it about here now that's fascinating that I might never experience again? Sometimes it's those choices that make a big difference in those other 22 hours a day. Like anybody, we succeed sometimes and we fail sometimes. But it's the belief that I can be the master of how I react to any situation, that it's not the situation that I should blame. Ultimately, if things go off the rails, it's how I reacted to it. What, you know, I had a whole realm of choices I could have made. Being in traffic, I could be leaning on the horn, or, you know, I could be watching light play on a tree and make sure I don't, you know, ram the car in front of me. But that's a better choice, I think.
So absolutely.
That, yeah.
You reframed the whole experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And you're actually living your actual life as opposed to thinking about what you're missing right now,
right.
The other routes you could have taken,
yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Walking over here today, because in L.A., nobody walks. Nobody, you know, you might see a pedestrian, and it's you know, you want to put them in a zoo because they're like, look, we found a pedestrian! but here, it was, I left the hotel, and I was a little early, so I sat with the last part of my coffee, and I love Manhattan for people watching. And just watching the different energy, the different rhythms, the different types of people, the diversity here that's so electric. And it was, you know, it was great. I was just completely immersed in the pleasure of watching this parade of humanity going by.
I mean, you are sort of a walking advertisement for the compounding benefits of meditation practice, because for so many people, you know, I'm only 8 years into this. There are days where I'm like, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Is this, especially after one of those sits where you are eyeing the clock and you're like, when is this going? But if you keep at it, there's a teacher who uses the phrase time and nature. In other words, I'm going to invoke again the word trust. If you just trust that the process of meditation works and let time and nature do its work,
yes, right.
That over time, it can show up with pretty big benefits.
Yeah, yeah. It's again, I use that building the mental muscle. idea. You know, I'm a bit of a gym rat, so I know that if I keep going to the gym and I work out and I feel better, and, you know, I look better on camera next to those 20-somethings with 2% body fat and everything. You know, so that's the same thing, really. It's investing in that and knowing that it pays dividends over time, and it pays dividends right away, too. But, yeah, there are definitely those days when it's like, really? Is it only 8 minutes already? Oh, my God.
I have to say, you do look damn good.
Thank you.
How old are you?
I'm 87 years old. I'm 62, actually.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, thank
you. So you're an advertisement for spending time in the gym, too.
Well, thanks.
And are you super careful about what you eat?
I'm not super careful, but I am somewhat careful. I kid about it, but it's true. I have the great incentive of working alongside these incredible artists and athletes who are these dancers. And it keeps you, you know, it's like, okay, if I have to stand next to Derek Hough and Cheryl Burke, I better go to the gym.
Yeah,
you know?
would do that to me too.
Yeah. But also I love the results of what it feels like. Sometimes in the midst of, like, I did a training session yesterday, and I didn't really want to go, but I did, and I was whining about the leg exercises. It's like a running joke with my trainer and all that. But then about 20 minutes in, you know, you start. The blood's moving, and you know, you're cracking a few jokes, and you're having fun, and it feels good, and that's very often what sitting is like for meditation. You know, just and then suddenly 5-6 minutes in, you feel that first insinuation of that electric connectivity, and it's like, oh, I'm so glad I did this. You know, that's the more common reaction.
As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans.
It's so cool to sit here with somebody who you kind of think you know, because I've just watched you for decades and realize how much more is there. And I suspect that everybody listening or watching this is going to feel the same way.
Well, you know, and my goal, going back to when I did the book and in conversations like this, why I was so looking forward to chatting with you about this, I just see the value in it, you know, and if it can make somebody give it a shot. And the thing that's important, I think, that there's no religious connection to this. Is a practice. It's just a sort of, I mean, there can be, certainly, but you don't have to feel like if you're of a certain religious belief that you're going rogue if you meditate. It's a lovely adjunct to, and it can make your religious life even more. I don't happen to be religious myself, but I could certainly see where it would help enrich somebody in a religious life just by virtue of the practice of staying aware of your life as it unfolds.
Yeah, it's secular. Yeah. I believe it's exercise for the brain and the mind. And in terms of from what I'm not particularly religious myself, but friends of mine who are say that their prayer life is transformed because they're
absolutely see that.
They're tending their to-do lists less frequently and actually focusing on the divine connection they're seeking.
Yeah, yeah.
This has been fascinating, but I want to dive just in, out of personal curiosity, into your background of how you became Tom Bergeron. So
I blame my parents for that.
Yeah, well, for that's the very beginning.
But
you grew up in Haverhill, Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah.
And how did you get into hosting?
I was at Haverhill High School, and I found out that there was a an English teacher and a public speaking teacher who worked part-time at the local radio station. And I thought, okay. I was basically like a heat-seeking missile. I'm going to get in his class, and I'm going to impress the hell out of him and see where that – and I did. I got into his public speaking class, and he ended up introducing me to the owner of the local radio station. And in my senior year in high school, I was working in radio part time.
So were you a class clown?
Yeah, a bit. Freshman year in high school, the English teacher, the history teacher, would award at the end of the year whoever was the biggest cut up, the Boob of the Year award, and I won it. I'm proud to say. I would like to think with a more erudite humor than the runner up.
Or all previous.
Yeah, all previous. Yes, boobs. It was. Yeah, I would like to think it was more of an Algonquin roundtable humor that I brought to that class in Haverhill High.
So senior year, you're already doing radio? You just kept with it?
I kept with it. I was going to, you know, we were talking before we started that my oldest daughter graduated from Emerson College, a wonderful facility in Boston, and I was going to go there to get a degree in broadcasting in the hopes of getting a radio job. But I had a radio job already, so I thought, maybe I'll just put that off for a while, and stayed and worked. And then my boss threatened to fire me unless I went to school. He said, I didn't hire you to not go to college. So I ended up going to a local community college just to take courses, just to keep the job. I didn't want to annoy him, and ended up working with a theater company, and then studied with a mime in Maine, who a wonderful teacher, Tony Montanaro, this brilliant, brilliant guy, who studied with Marceau. And so I was doing, at one point, a morning radio show and evening mime performances with a troupe. And a buddy of mine said, you know, it's fascinating. When we hear you, we can't see you. And when we see you, we can't hear you.
So you're a mime.
Yeah. You know, just sit down.
Yeah, you're good.
Illusionary walls, yeah. And you know.
I'll give you color commentary. He's doing the classic hand on the wall
thing.
Hand
on the wall, and then this can be misused in so many ways. But this is theoretically, it's just toothbrushing.
I'm not going to describe that.
No,
one.
Don't. That could go. That can go completely blue if
that
you wanted.
That
to.
That could cost both of us. That could damage our respective relationships with the Walt Disney Company.
Yes, that's true.
Who writes our checks. Yeah. So you're miming, hosting, studying, and then you end up. You were hosting a radio show in New Hampshire, and TV producers in Boston.
Yeah, I was doing a wonderful station in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. That's
a beautiful town.
Oh God, I love it.
It's a beautiful town.
Yeah, it really is. And to me, a New Englander, that is quintessential.
Yes.
New England.
Yes.
So that's where I always gravitate. When I was working in New York, and so many friends would go, you know, to Long Island or the Hamptons, my wife and I would keep going right back to New Hampshire. What was the original question? I forget.
Okay, yeah. The TV producers in Boston.
So I was doing the radio show in Portsmouth, and it was a very improvisational show. I'd play music, certainly, but I'd have musicians come in and perform live, and occasionally we'd do fundraising live performances from the local theater that were sort of a Saturday Night Live takeoff that I would write with some of the other DJs. So there was this great – they gave me a lot of rope. And I was creatively just in this really very energetic period. And the station signal got into the Boston market, into the North Shore anyway. And there were people who were producers in Boston TV who were listening to the show. And out of the blue, I was getting these calls, you want to come down and audition for this show on Channel 5 in Boston? Want to come down and audition for this kid show on Channel 4. So I did, and that kind of the TV thing happened by accident.
So were you were on People Are Talking, but did you also do the evening magazine?
No, I'd fill in on that. I was, prior to doing the People Are Talking show, I started at WBZ TV in Boston in 81.
That was Channel 4,
and at that time
was NBC.
That's
now
right,
it's CBS.
Now it's CBS, yeah. And I was doing just, you know, basically a weekly kid show that we would pre-tape. It was like Evening Magazine, but for kids.
That's why I saw it. Because in 1981, I was 10.
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Super Kids, it was called. It was on the weekends. So I got my foot in the door, and then I'd fill in on different things. It was a format called For Today. You would host daytime programming. You'd be on for 90 seconds and a minute, and a, you know, a minute here, 2 minutes there. Glenn Close was my guest on one of those. We promoted two movies in 53 seconds. And at the end, because it was live, and we get off the air, and she looked at me, and she went, "What just happened?" But so that led to them saying, "Oh, the host of people are talking. It's taking, you want to fill in?" And then ultimately, they offered me that job when they chose not to renew the other guy's contract. And yeah, so that all happened because of a radio show.
And when did America's Funniest Home Video start?
That happened because I was doing Hollywood Squares in syndication, and I would go back to Boston every so often to host the New England Emmy Awards, to just sort of keep those connections alive and see old friends. And Vin DeBona, who's the creator of AFE, also from the Boston area, also had worked at WBZ, and was getting an award that night. And I was ad-libbing my way through the hosting. And his late mother, Jean, leaned over to him and said, "You should hire him." And he was actually talking to ABC about bringing the show back, because it had been a series of specials at that point. It wasn't a weekly show anymore. So he said, "Yeah, ABC." So at that award ceremony, I sat down. He goes, "Would you be interested in hosting AFV?" It was kind of like, "Well, yeah, I'd have to do it a little different than Bob, because, you know,
Bob Saget.
I don't have the same, I don't do the character voices and all that stuff." But we figured that out as we went along. But yeah, that was how it started.
And when you're in your personal life, are you like at a party? Do you feel the need to host everything?
No, I'm not a big party person. Here's the interesting sort of twisted wires. On a live TV show in front of whatever, 20 million people, bedroom slippers. Party, small talk, I'm looking for the exits, my upper lip starts to sweat. Unless it's work related, if it's like like a neighborhood association party or something like that, Lois, my wife, would have to hear from people, "Where'd Tom go?" Oh, he's probably out driving around so he can refocus.
What is that?
I don't know. I'm lousy at small talk. I'm a bit of a loner anyway. I'm not a big party person. I like smaller groups, you know. I'm apt to get a little claustrophobic sometimes.
In large groups.
Yeah.
But what about when you're mobbed by people who know you from TV?
Well, I was at the gang from Dancing with the Stars is doing a tour. And so my wife and I went to White Plains the other night because we're in Connecticut and we're nearby. And naively, I thought, we got a couple tickets and we'll just show up. And the moment we were walking into the venue, people who were there, big fan base of the show, you know, and they're, "Tommy," you know, and... And it turned into, it was a very flattering situation, but it was a bit overwhelming. A lot of people wanting pictures and autographs. And my wife was an absolute sweetheart taking pictures for them. But security finally had to say, "Okay, we got to just kind of, you know, back this up." And for a while I was fine, but I did start to feel a little bit... penned in.
You know, there's this trope about comedians that many comedians, while super charismatic and hilarious on stage, are often very shy in person.
Yeah.
You think that's kind of what we're talking about here?
Absolutely. I would read interviews with Johnny Carson, and I got to work with Ed McMahon, his sidekick, on stuff when I did muscular dystrophy stuff when Jerry Lewis was doing it. And Ed McMahon and I talked a lot about Carson and how quiet and sort of shy he was away from hosting The Tonight Show, and very much a loner. And I've read interviews with Letterman or people who've worked with him say the same thing. And I think there is a bit of a common strain, and that in some ways it's easier to do the hosting because I feel more in control. I know what the parameters are. Okay, we're a two-hour show. There are all these moving parts, but I know what the moving parts are. I know in real life, like at a party, Lois, my wife, who was a producer, had the best advice for me, and it helped. It still doesn't make me want to go to parties much more, but when I do go, she said, "Find the person in the room who looks more uncomfortable than you feel and interview them." You love hearing about people's lives and why they... And people generally love to talk about themselves.
Yes, they do.
So find that person and don't worry about the rest of it. And that worked. That was really helpful advice.
Is there anything I should have asked you but didn't? Any areas you wanted
to go? Math. Any math questions, I'm really – no.
Oh, wait. There was a story you were going to tell me about the Three Stooges.
Oh, well, because where we are in California now when I'm out doing Dancing with the Stars is only a few miles away from the motion picture facility home and facility in Woodland Hills. So when I was 16 years old, my folks were out. My sister was having a sleepover at a friend's house, and I did what any 16-year-old kid left alone – in Haverhill, Massachusetts, would have done in 1972, I decided to call the Three Stooges. So I called information. I knew Mo Howard and Larry Fine were still alive. I said, Mo Howard, Larry Fine. The operator says, well, we've got several M. Howards. I've got one Larry Fine. I said, I'll take that number. And I called it, and his mother answered. I thought, that doesn't work out. His mother would be 109. She said, oh, no, it's not that Larry Fine who lives here, but I do know where he is. He's at the motion picture home. She gave me the number because they had other calls like
that. The motion picture home.
Yeah, in Woodland Hills. That's what it was. A motion picture and television home, I think it was called.
So it's like a nursing home for stars?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he had suffered a stroke, and he was recuperating there. So I called with my heart beating like a jackhammer, and the guy at the switchboard goes, yeah, Larry, yeah, let me get him. And he comes back, he says, he's playing poker. He has a good hand. Can you call back in half an hour? And I did. Larry comes on the phone, and he was still very recognizably Larry. And about 10 or 15 minutes into this conversation, and he was so gracious with this kid from Massachusetts, he goes, you want Mo's number? He gives me Mo's home phone number. I called Mo's house. His wife answered, put Mo on the phone. Mo sounds just like Mo of the films. And he said, who gave you this number? And I said, Larry did. And there was this wonderful pause as I remember it. And he went, Larry. You lame brain. But over 18 months, I talked to them probably half a dozen times.
No kidding.
Yeah. And
what'd you ask him?
Just about the films, about their background, about this, you know, what they thought about comedy now, everything. And luckily, some of those tapes survived.
Oh, you recorded them?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And when I was promoting the book that we alluded to years ago, I was on Howard Stern's show. And he's a big Stooges fan. And he said, do those tapes exist? I don't know. I'll look for them. Found them. Found a half hour with Mo and about 20 minutes with Larry. And we turned it into a 90-minute special, which also features a lot of their Stooge parody stuff they've done on the Stern Show. And you can find it, I think, online now. It's called Stooges Lost and Found. And you can hear, as I did one time, it's very surreal, driving to do a production meeting for Dancing with the Stars down Laurel Canyon. I happen to have the Sirius station, Howard Sirius station on, and I'm listening to 16-year-old me interview Mo Howard, while then 59-year-old me was driving to work to host Dancing with the Stars. It was kind of cool.
That's a trip.
Yeah.
Howard Stern is also a TM.
Yes, he is. Yeah, he is.
Such a pleasure to sit and talk to you.
Same here, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Same here, you bet.
If people want to find the book, if they want to find more information about you.
Well, if they want to find the book, it's holding up some of the finest windows in America right now. And but there is an audio version. You can get it on Audible and listen to me drone on for 6.5 hours.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think people will like that. and what about you're on Twitter?
Twitter.
Any other places to find you that you're putting stuff out?
Not really. You can usually find me at a Starbucks.
Cool.
Yeah, just hanging out.
And ignoring everybody and not talking to them.
I talk.
You do?
I talk, yeah.
Briefly.
Briefly, yeah.
But if the lip starts to sweat. Then
just let them back away.
I mean, just such a pleasure to sit and talk to you.
Same here.
Really, really fun.
I'm looking forward to this.
Okay, that does it for another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you liked it, please take a minute to subscribe, rate us. Also, if you want to suggest topics you think we should cover or guests that we should bring in, hit me up on Twitter at Dan B. Harris. Importantly, I want to thank the people who produce this podcast, Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, and the rest of the folks here at ABC who helped make this thing possible. We have tons of other podcasts. You can check them out at abcnewspodcasts.com. I'll talk to you next Wednesday.
If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.